And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And today we're going to be talking about two places in the world where the U.S. is, and its friends are working very hard for regime change. That would be Burundi, and second is Syria. We're going to talk to Krista Burr, who has lived and worked in both Rwanda and Burundi, has been familiar with that area for many years, followed very closely the events of Rwanda, not 1994, but all the way leading up to it, 1990 through 94, which was a long war, resembling somewhat the situation in terms of the demographics and politics of that of Burundi. About which we will talk today. And in the latter half, we're going to be talking to Eva Bartlett, who is a great journalist who also is very brave. She's been into the troubled part of – she's lived in Gaza. She's lived in Lebanon, and she has visited Syria four times, I believe, in the past couple of 3 years. So we're very anxious to hear from those people who – are closest to these situations is what, and in this case, we have two wonderful guests. Now, while we're waiting to for the contact with Chris DeBoer, I want to mention that this is quite a significant situation that is unfolding in the Middle East, where the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has executed 47 people in one day. The most notable in terms of his political significance in the region is the Shia Imam Sheikh Nimir. And but it is, we really have to underline that this situation is, it would appear to be Saudi Arabia's determination, as the best friend of the United States in the region, to see if they can really produce this a crisis with Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and but more broadly, the ISIS strategy. Frankly, Saudi Arabia has the ISIS strategy, which is to try to inflame differences between Muslims, because at the end of the day, it's the U.S. strategy. Most noteworthy advocate of it is former Secretary of I was going to call him Secretary of State, Mr. Brzezinski. I think he was actually a national security advisor to Jimmy Carter. He had this really ugly theory, and which he's been trying to make work. He's like a kid, you know, playing with matches and dynamite. But his notion was that he could create a fight between Sunni Muslims and Shia. This is, in my view, is a Western fantasy that they think they know, that they treat religion, they treat people like they're bugs under glass, and that you can experiment on them and you can predict results. Actually, they're not going to get this dream. Is going not Mr. Brzezinski is not going to work. The Saudi royal family is quite happy to carry it out because they, so long as they are getting their weapons from the United States and are filthy rich and filthy, they're happy. But executing 47 people in one day. Just before we get to Chris DeBoer, I'm going to mention one of them was a 19-year-old who had protested in Saudi Arabia the bombing of Gaza, and he was arrested and given a death sentence for that. You might want to, that's something to meditate on. But I think we're joined now by Chris DeBoer in Brussels. Are you there, Chris?
Yes, Mr. Third, I'm down.
Well, thank you.
May I say, Phil?
I'm very glad we could talk to you, Chris, because with the reporting on Burundi, the reporting of the all issues in the Great Lakes area having to do with Rwanda and Burundi, and to a lesser extent Uganda, I guess, and and Congo. There seems to be a kind of language being introduced, which is highly inflammatory, with a kind of logic which says this something really awful is about to happen or could happen, and it's very important that we rescue. We send in outside forces to rescue. Meanwhile, if I read the press from Burundi, and by the way, I tell people Burundi-24 would be a good place to start to get information on the internet. It's a totally different picture. I'd like to know, how do you characterize? What do you see is unfolding there in Burundi, and where is this crisis coming from? What's the source?
Well, it's not so easy to determine the causes of that.
That's a large one to throw to you. Yes.
Yes, of course. We thought at the beginning, after the peace talkings in Arusha and the agreement in Arusha, that afterwards everything went better, let's say that. There was a certain stability in Burundi, and something disappeared the last 10 years, and that was the ethnical conflict was at least, there wasn't any, don't want to say there wasn't any ethnical conflict, but that wasn't a hot item during 10 years. And even when the trouble started, even then, ethnical problems weren't in front of it. Of course, there wasn't how do you call it? There were some problems linked mainly at the position of the Stark administration. And a concentration of power which we have in almost all those countries. At the same time, we know that Burundi is a really poor country, and the promises Nkurunziza made when he won the elections in 2005, well, he couldn't make them all. The economical situation in Burundi isn't that flourishing for everyone. You can say you have those that do. Sorry, Phil. The haves and the have-nots. Mm-hmm. And the have-nots are in majority in those countries, not only in Burundi, but in all those other countries. You see that from the rural side, people come to the cities, but there is an underemployment in those cities. And what will you do with those youngsters? Youngsters who studied, youngsters who have information. You can't give them an employment. So there is a part of insatisfaction on the desires of a rather large group, mainly in the cities. Mm-hmm. And that seems for me one of the major problems that the government, the Burundian government, couldn't resolve. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, at the end of the 10 years of empowerment of Mr. Nkurunziza, the actual president, well, the situation was not so easy. Local government thought it would be better to keep a certain stability. And when they discussed that stability, they got even the support of the Eastern African countries. Mm-hmm. inside Burundi, there is a large group of opposition. But once again, that group of opposition wasn't at the beginning of the problems, wasn't oriented for an ethnic problem. It was mainly a political problem, mm-hmm. a problem of power and of power sharing. Mm-hmm. That seems for me the most important thing. But afterwards, when the fire got higher and higher, some opponents tried to orient to make an ethnical problem of it, because that's the way they could have some support. Abroad.
And that is where we are. I mean, are we not? I mean, we read that whenever I see a statement by some of these people called the opposition, they're basically appealing over the head of their government to outside powers, primarily European. I mean, the African Union's come in, but really they're directing their question towards, you know, why doesn't the UN do something for us and come and rescue us. But on that, could we separate, you know, this word opposition is already being kind of confused, right? Because there is an actual political opposition who are in office and in the parliament. Mm-hmm. But then there are these people who seem to be very well armed with uniforms. And they are ruthless. They come out of nowhere. And yet they're having these talks in Entebbe, and I guess they're going to move it to Arusha. Again, I hate to hear that word, Arusha. It has such bad echo of bad things that happened. But now, and the Mr. President Museveni, who convened these meetings, he wants these armed people, in my impression. Maybe you have a different, I'd ask you that. But he wants those with the guns and who tried to make a coup against the democratic government, he wants them to participate. Somebody's really fishing for trouble. But by the way, am I accurate? I mean, when the word opposition, they're trying to transform people who are political opponents, who are there, and then and that's accurate, but they also want to include actually people who practice terror and who are armed by somebody with a lot of money. Mm. And call them both opposition.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an accurate picture?
Well, that's a good way of describing it, of course. But one say that's the only situation. One of the main problems is, of course, those groups are armed. Where does those arms come from? And that's something we can't see immediately. In the region there are so many arms. As well in Burundi as in Rwanda, even of course in Congo, in the Congo. But it's so strange. Sometimes it's so strange. Some weeks ago there was an attack with heavy arms on at least 3 military posts. Mm. Who can afford that? Is that the opposition that can do that? I am not quite sure about that. Who are those people who are taking military posts? And then afterwards, the mass killings around. That seems for us a picture we already saw before as well in Burundi in the period of 72, the Hutu genocide, mm-hmm. as well in the years before, for instance, in Rwanda. Destabilization is provoked, and then there are some there are killings, even mass killings, which are immediately attributed at the official path. But is that the truth? That's something that has to be investigated. Mm-hmm. And that investigation, I think that is one of the first things we have to do,
mm-hmm.
or the international community has to do.
Yes. Well, now that raises that the international community always turns out to be look a lot like somebody I never heard of before when they get these things, you know, when yes. they come to or they show up. I was interested in terms of this. You say that we do need to get to the bottom of it, but you know, in terms of media, I'm seeing reports that Radio France has a new story almost every day. About some inflammatory story about how bad the president of Burundi is. They're not doing stories like that about his neighbor in Kigali, but it's mm-hmm. Burundi. My impression is also people in Belgium, and we should talk about why Belgium is so looms so important, but that the leading public figures in Belgium have said really inflammatory things, which are on the face of them false, I believe. But could you talk about that? They obviously are impacting on our perceptions here, but are they not also contributing to the tension within Burundi? Because when Burundians read about themselves or hear of what's being alleged, that creates tension, I assume. But talk about Belgium's role and why they loom so large in the factor in Burundi and Rwanda?
Well, Belgians are really afraid from taking part in the conflict once again. What happened in Rwanda, probably it hadn't been foreseen, but we all have a kind of the political groups here in Belgium are even now really impressed on what happened in Rwanda, and they took the advantage of the winning parties, which is at this moment is the Paul Kagame,
mm-hmm.
and it is so hard to go to the as you. Before to go to the bottom of the problem. What happened in the years before 94? What happened exactly? Is it true that there was an attack coming from Uganda in October 90? Is it true that weapons came from Uganda to the that moment rebels of RPF? Is it true that there was an arm embargo in Rwanda, but not in Uganda? why was there a support to the RPF coming from Uganda, and why internationally there wasn't any reactions on that? The same problems. We see some similar things in the Burundian conflict now. We know what the government does, and every mistake of the government is pointed out. That's a good thing to do that. But at the other side, making a quarrel, you don't do it alone. There are also the other side. What happens there? Why don't we have more information of where does those arms come from? Who pays them? Who support them? How it's possible that there is an international support for that? Why does the media, the international media, don't go further than just the topic stories? That seems to us something we already saw before in other conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, and by the way, so many of these people involved are rather familiar names.
Yeah.
What did you think? Maybe you could tell our listeners who this gentleman is, but I was quite surprised that Entebbe, maybe I wasn't so surprised, but I was kind of surprised they let him be in the front. I noticed that when they're having these talks, one thing, the U.S. ambassador was there, but Pierre Buyoya, a former, they call him the former president. Well, he's the former a lot of things. Tell us who Pierre Buyoya is. Why is he at these talks?
Why is he at these talks? Well, that's rather a strange story on itself.
What's his background?
Well, he was a major at the Burundian army when at 87 he took over for the first time with the government, with a military putsch in 87.
The U.S. didn't complain about that.
Sorry?
I said the United States did not complain about that, nor Belgium, I guess.
No, there was not much complaint about him because like I said, the former president, Belgium had some troubles with him. Mm-hmm. Sorry. That brings us too far. But then afterwards, there is the important conference of La Baule in France, where President Mitterrand supported democracy and supported the governments that would invest in democracy. And at that moment, national elections were prepared in Burundi. And for the first time, a president was chosen by the people. That was Melchior Ndadaye. But 3 months later, he got killed in the second putsch, a putsch that probably was as well supported by RPF, Rwandan troops, who were present in Bujumbura at that moment. But, some pointed also Buyoya for that. The interim president. Yeah?
Yes.
You're still following me.
Yes.
The interim president, Cyprien Ntaryamira, well, he was in Dar es Salaam in April 1994 and was killed together with President Habyarimana from Rwanda. Mm-hmm. That was on less than 6 months, two presidents who were killed. He was replaced by another Hutu president, but in July 1995, it was once again a coup d'etat, a putsch, which brought once again Pierre Buyoya out of power.
Mm-hmm.
Some really strange things we got at that moment. An international embargo, which was very harmful for the entire Burundian people. And they started peacekeeping talks in Arusha. And for Burundi, Arusha isn't that bad at all. Arusha brought some solutions for Burundi.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, wasn't one of the solutions that Buyoya leave the country and mind its own business for a while?
Well, there was one of the major agreements where that will be an immunity for the former president.
Mm-hmm.
And that there will be a power sharing system.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the main problems, and main issues was also that there would be a guaranteed part taken up by Hutus and Tutsis, which was very important because in Rwanda they decided that there were no ethnic groups anymore, but in Burundian side, it was written in the constitution that 40% of the administration, army, and ministers would be Tutsi, and 60% would be Hutu. That was a
pretty generous settlement.
That was really very generous because there are less than 20% Tutsis in the country and a little bit more than 80% Hutus. Mm-hmm. So that was a compromise which worked for now more than 10 years. Mm-hmm. It worked, and it kept the level of ethnical opposition, well, it kept it abroad. That was rather a good thing. But then, yes, of course, power sharing is rather difficult, not only in African countries, even in our countries, you know it as well. Mm-hmm. And, I think that it wasn't a good thing from Kurunziza to accept a third mandate. You can discuss on the problem of its legal or not. That's an open discussion. I can understand that some say, well, the first mandate of Kurunziza wasn't an elected one. It was decided on Arusha. And he got only his first mandate from 2010 until now. So he isn't elected for only the second time.
Yes.
Well, that's a position that is defendable.
Very defendable.
It's a defendable. It wasn't the best solution, but it's defendable. Now, at that moment, is it on other countries like Belgium or other to decide that it is illegal? No, that's not our. It's not necessary our position we had to take. Mm-hmm. But some did, yeah. And why? But you asked me about Boyoya. Boyoya, rather strange. He was invited at the European Parliament to discuss about the peaceful translation of power in his country. But he was the actor of three putches, of three turnovers of the government, which made at each time several victims. But he was invited to the European Parliament to make that discussion and to present his so-called point of views. He seems to be, for some, he seems to be the hero of the country, but, well, that's not immediately my opinion.
Mm-hmm. It's utterly remarkable that he could be in such a situation. And it just has any, I would assume any Burundian, or certainly anybody looking on from outside, thinking about it, it's almost like a signal that he and his friends intend once again to seize power if they can do it. And the Europeans are already agree because they keep giving him jobs that they even pay him for. He has some UN jobs since, as you say, he's involved in three coups or putches. And his reward is he works for the UN, and they have a big talk about the fate of his country, and they include him. If we watch individuals like that, we can. In my opinion, the mask is removed. But let me just ask you one last point, because I want to mention this individual, the former deputy prime minister of Belgium, gave remarks recently talking about Kurunziza, and he said some inflammatory things. Is it true that he said that he thought it would have been good if Kurunziza had been killed in that coup?
Well, I don't know the exact speech of, I think you talked about Louis Michel.
Louis Michel, I'm sorry, I must have got the name. Louis Michel's remarks.
Louis Michel, that's the one. Well, it's rather an impressive man.
One of our Western leaders. He's one of our NATO people. He's a big shot.
Yes, of course, but he is of value as the American president candidate, Mr. Trump.
Trump,
has.
Yeah.
But the only problem with Louis Michel is that it's father of our actually a prime minister.
He's the father of today's prime minister.
He is the father of today's prime minister, and he is a European Parliament 1960s in the European Parliament, where he started a group called the Friends of Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And if we say today the Friends of Rwanda, that means the Friends of Mr. Paul Kagame, more that than the Friends of the Rwandese people.
Yeah. By the way, yes, he was involved in as an RPF supporter in 1994, am I right?
Well, later on, yes. He was a supporter of RPF and is still a supporter of RPF.
Yeah. So, well, of course. But I guess the last point there is, it is, if there's extremism and crisis mongering, it's coming from Brussels and Washington and London and Paris. Would you agree?
Well, no, not exactly that. It isn't coming only from that. Of course, there is a freedom in Belgium and in France to speak out what we think about it, which wasn't any more possible in Burundi. The Burundian government made some, that's my opinion, made some mistakes in trying to silence the opposition and opposition radio and medias. That wasn't a good thing to do. That wasn't careful what they did. They could have handled it on a quite other way. There were some problems in the government, of course, there were some problems, but is violence a solution of problems? It has never been that. There must be, and there is, a way to come to peaceful solutions. Perhaps once again in Arusha. Arusha did a good thing for Burundi in 2005. Well, perhaps that could be one of the possible solutions. Now, I don't think, personally, I don't think that as mediator, Mr. Museveni, president of Uganda, will be the best counterpart. But perhaps we could. They could find somebody with a more acceptable profile.
Yeah, somebody who's not basically a lifetime president lecturing somebody else about his two terms, or a supplier of arms to rebels in Rwanda in 1990. And so, part of my talking about supplier of soldiers to his soldiers. It is awfully close to being just a terrible joke. You know, if one looked at it clearly, who these people are. Chris de Boer, we're really grateful. You're a man with a great experience in this. We hope we can talk to you more because this story is just getting started, in my opinion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Phil.
Chris de Boer, and you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, and I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and I think we're going to take, is it a break?